Hello friends, we're back once again. It me, Bethany Rutter, and I'm here with my good friend and business partner. It me,
Alice Slater. And once again, we're recording back of house in none other than Waterstones Gower Street, my alma mater and favourite bookshop in London.
It's your professional alma mater and it's across the road from my actual alma mater, UCL.
Yeah.
Where so I had many happy years.
History for both of us.
Yes.
So many thanks to you, Gower Street, for letting us record here.
Thank you so much, Waterstones Gower Street. You the best. So, we're going to talk about...
We're going to do some non-fiction.
We're going to do some spicy non-fic.
Fuck me. When was the last time we did non-fiction?
A long time ago. Can't tell you when.
Probably true crime.
Could be, yeah. It could be that.
It's very rare that I feel like we both read the same non-fiction that isn't true crime.
Yeah. Yeah, it's true. Yeah. Yeah. But this one just felt like a real... perfect moment, as Martin McCutcheon would say.
And a perfect match.
Yeah.
A match made in heaven.
So, shall we start by talking about the one that has been on people's lips a lot in the last couple of months?
Yes.
Which is In the Dream House by Carmen Maria Machado? Machado? Machado?
Machado?
Machado.
I think we'll go with that. Historically, we've been saying Machado.
Which is probably wrong.
But I do believe I heard someone say... Machado recently. And I realised, I think like getting people's names is really important, but you don't fucking know that you're getting it wrong sometimes.
Yeah, it's true.
Excellent example being Gillian Flynn.
Yeah, so many people call her Gillian Flynn. Yes, In the Dream House has been a real... I mean, it came out, like, within days of the year beginning. It was the first Thursday of the year.
Yeah.
And instantly was a hit among our demographic.
Do you want to nutshell it?
No, you do it.
Okay. So, In the Dream House is a memoir of Carmen's a formative relationship that she had that turned out to be very abusive. The memoir, however, is told through a kind of different literary devices. So, each chapter is approaching her story from a different kind of perspective or angle or through a different lens. Mostly resting on, I forget what it's called, the fairy tale index.
Mm.
I can't remember what it's called, but there's a way of indexing fairy tales, the and tropes folklore, of fairy tales yeah. from yeah. around the world, because quite often you'll find the same... Basically, it was created to try, I don't know if you know this, but...
I do not know this.
I learned this from Jen Campbell. I attended a workshop that she did on the history of fairy tales. But basically, it was to try and index... fairy tales, because we often don't know where they originated, and obviously they would spread around the world, so, you know, is it the same story, is it a different story?
Yes.
Yeah, so the numbers, that they're all, each kind of fairy tale trope is numbered, and so some numbers will appear in, like, multiple stories, and some just in one or two.
That's the footnotes that we get. With throughout the stories,
when she reaches something that's a fairy tale trope, she footnotes it and explains through this index what the trope is.
But more broadly, the chapters are very short and are divided by literary device or theme or genre. Sometimes it's written in, like, you know, it would be, each chapter is called Dream House as something.
Yeah.
So it could be, a very memorable one is Choose Your Own Adventure. So Dream House is Choose Your Own Adventure, where it's a, you know, it looks like the beginning of an argument between her and her partner.
And it's like, what do you do next? Turn to X page if you remain silent. Do you fight back
or do you blah, 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 do you, and then turn to X page. But obviously, as with many abusive relationships, whichever option you choose, it all ends with you being... in trouble and them feeling aggrieved.
Yeah.
And then another one, what's another one that, like...
So, I mean, my favourite chapter is a whole chapter describing an episode of Star Trek in which Captain Jean-Luc Picard is gaslit by a Cardassian. I nearly said a Cardassian then.
Of course you did. Always on your mind.
Changed. Yeah. I was a big Star Trek fan as a kid, so... he's kidnapped by a Cardassian, I believe, I may be wrong, and gaslit, and this whole chapter is just describing that scene, or this episode, and how it, made her think, like, watching it years later, how it made her reflect on her relationship is so fucking moving, and so clever, and such a unique way of telling a story that is not really told very often. What a tremendous book. Did you love it?
Yeah, I loved it.
Fuck me.
I loved it. I just feel like you don't often read, or one does not see traditionally published books about abusive relationships, let alone between women. And yeah. I think that was something that was so interesting in that book, was it dealing with that lack in culture of material about abusive female relationships. I feel like it really was aware of that.
Yeah, definitely.
And obviously, it's not the only one, but it felt...
Definitely not, yeah. But certainly in mainstream publishing, yeah. I couldn't name another one. And I feel like that's something that she herself talks about, that because it doesn't really exist in pop culture, it never occurred to her that that's what was happening to her.
Yeah.
Like, by default, she assumed that she was in a safe relationship.
Because it was a woman.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, I mean, that alone is so upsetting and so lonely. But also the fact that she was always surrounded by people who could see it.
Yeah.
And did everything they could, you know? Like, she was taken care of by, like, her, like, chosen family, you know, all her loved ones around her. But there's nothing that you can really, truly do for someone in a situation like that apart from be there for them. And there's something so sad about that.
I agree.
Yeah, I thought it was amazing.
Yeah. I really am. I'm really not surprised at how much it has resonated with people. It's such a unique book as well. It's very unique. Like, I've literally never read another book like that. Have you?
No, not at all.
It's so experimental in a very literal sense, in that it is explicitly experimenting.
Yeah.
It's not just that you as the reader are reading it and you're like, oh, what's going on? It's like the author's project is to experiment with literary form, which I think is really cool.
And like, it says a lot, like, how do you tell this story? You know, yeah. Like, in trying to find a way to articulate the messiness of it and the shame and, like, the pride of, like, actually being okay but still healing. And I don't know, like, just how do you even begin, like, picking apart and putting that kind of nebulous situation that involves so much self-reflection and therapy and looking back and re-articulating things that happened in your own head? How do you approach that in a linear way? Like,
yeah,
you can't.
Yeah.
Right? So instead of, like, approaching it from a kind of traditional storytelling narrative, she has just retrod the same thing again and again in different angles, different ways, different kind of expressions. And also it shows a lot about, like, who she is as a person, that she rests her trauma on, like, quite an analytical platform.
Yes,
you know?
So true.
Like, as an academic, that's her kind of way of processing it, is to apply her kind of critical thought, and it's just so fucking smart.
It is. I truly loved it. I really loved it. Obviously, it's very, you know, difficult subject matter, and it's probably not going to be for everyone, but I feel like if you are curious about it, 100% recommend. Also, no spoilers, but there is a very, like, moving and delightful plot twist,
yes,
in the book, that if you don't know a lot about her biography, will just delight you.
Yeah.
Delighted me.
Yeah, me too. I think that's the thing, even though it's a very, like, very dark subject matter, the book itself, you don't feel like you're wading through, like, trauma.
Yeah.
You know? And obviously, like, a big caveat that her experiences don't match mine at all. So obviously, if you have experienced that kind of an abusive relationship, your reading of it will almost certainly be incredibly different. But from my perspective, this, like, I don't want to call it, like, a twist, but, like, this, like, beautiful...
unexpected element of it.
Yeah, like, this beautiful, like, happening.
Yeah.
Definitely, like, meant that I left with quite a kind of bright heart, you know?
Yes.
I left with, like, a little spring in my step.
Yes.
Like, yeah,
yeah,
I loved it.
I definitely prefer it to Her Body and Other Parties as a single book.
Yeah, famously lukewarm short story, Bethany.
Yeah.
That's,
yeah,
like, the least catchy fucking nickname I could have come up with then.
I really liked Her Body and Other Parties, but I loved this.
Yeah.
I really loved it. And I'm incredibly hyped to see what she does next.
Me too. I wonder if she will do a novel.
It could be anything. That's the thing. Like,
yeah,
from a short story collection to this wildly experimental non-fiction memoir, like, It could be anything. And isn't that so cool? She's just so clever.
Also, very important fact about Carmen. She was a life journal user.
All the best people
added to the fucking Hall of Fame.
Yeah. I also feel like between being an active life journal, well, a previous life journal user, and being a plus size legend,
yeah,
I just feel like guaranteed cool.
Exactly.
Like, definitely a cool person.
Yeah. And she does talk about how some elements of what led her to remain in this relationship, even when she started seeing red flags, was, like, her body contributed to that.
Yeah.
Right? And that was something that I also found really interesting and quite refreshing to read, was just, you know, a plus-size woman basically saying, well, I assumed that she really loved me because, you know,
I'm fat, so, yeah, you know.
I'm fat, so she must be looking beyond that.
Yeah.
And there's something just so tragically familiar about that, you know? Yeah. Like, assuming that, like, your body is kind of irrelevant, that if someone wants you, it's because, you know, they must really care.
Therefore, it's more worthwhile staying in this relationship because it must be, like, deep.
Exactly, yeah.
Which it's not. Yeah, I just feel like I love reading stuff by plus-size women because I'm like, it's just so interesting seeing, like, the similarities, the differences, the things that we share and the things that I'm like, oh, actually, I don't relate to that. Like,
yeah.
I feel like it's such a... I think I was talking to Eliza Clark about this, author of upcoming Boy Parts, at Annabelle Banks' launch the other night, and she said something like, not to blow my own horn, but she was she was reading my book, No Big Deal, I've heard of it. And she was saying,
see how I tripped over you to get that joke in first?
Yeah, she was saying, like, it's, and she's not plus size, but just how unusual it is to read a book that does not have a default thin protagonist. And obviously, imagine what that's like for us as, like, fat women who read loads, to be reading something that actually resonates with us.
To read
like this narrative of, like, a fat woman life that you're like, yeah. And that's so rare because of this, like, even written by plus size women, often this default thin protagonist.
Yeah, 100%.
It's so illuminating.
I want to read more fat lady books.
Me too.
That's what I fucking have to say.
But, like, good ones.
But good ones.
Yeah.
Also with actual fat people.
Yes. So, yeah, I'm really hyped to read more from the brain of Carmen.
Me too. Especially because these books came out quite close together, really, didn't they? Like, Her Body and Other Parties came out autumn 2017.
Yes.
In the US, it came out... Oh, no, yeah, it ended up coming out the same year.
Yeah.
They brought the publication forward in the UK. How I remember this shit. Honestly, I impressed myself. My mind. And then this has come out, winter 2020. So, like, a two-year gap. And even the fact that, knowing how slow publishing can be, like, she must have been working on this.
Yeah. That's the thing. We don't know, like, where, at what point all of these were brought into existence.
I do have a fun fact for you if you're listening to the pod. You can go to my Instagram account at smokingtofuno_g, little throwback from my old Twitter handle. Scroll until you find my picture of In the Dream House, orange cover, pink background. I was part of a little Instagram tour with Serpent's Tale, and I got to ask a question, and I asked Carmen whether or not she used her own live journal to help, like, inform sections of the book. So you can go read her answer there, and also click to the other profiles and see what questions they ask, because she talked a little bit about the writing process and her inspo, and it was really interesting.
We love a forthcoming author. We love authors who are, you know, up for answering these, like, gnarly questions.
Yeah, like, tell me your secrets, tell me stuff.
Speaking of gnarly,
yes,
the second book that we read is Against a Memoir by Michelle T. Alice asked me what I thought about this book.
What did you think of this book?
This is, like, my literal new favourite non-fiction book in the
whole
world.
Shut up, really?
I love this book so much. Oh, I literally was just like, I wanted to scream all the time while I was reading it. I loved it so much.
Okay, this makes me feel so fucking happy. I loved it too. I thought it was so incredible. And I had no idea when you said, ask me what I think of this book. I had no idea what you were going to say, because we haven't talked about it.
I loved it.
Nutshell it for me, baby.
So it's a collection of essays from across her career. it's just, I guess it's like a way of telling her life story through these essays, which are not chronological. They're not necessarily, they have not been written for this book to be published together. They are collected from across different platforms, speeches, websites.
It's just like a collection of everything that she's had published, presumably everything. A vast selection of her work.
Yeah.
Organised in a manner, not chronological, but by theme. So, like, there's all of her pop culture stuff comes first. So, like, not just reviews, like, kind of critical essays about different movies and books that she was kind of excited by at the time. And then also more memoir-based stuff as well. Some great fucking stuff about, like, the queer scene.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. You know what it really reminded me of? In a funny sort of way.
Tell me.
Paul takes the form of a mortal girl.
I knew you were going to say that.
I've probably said it to you before. But in the way that Paul takes the form of a mortal girl by Andrea Lawler, this book against memoir feels like a kind of tour of different queer scenes from, like, the 90s and noughties.
Yeah, I think one of the most interesting bits is when they go to Michigan Women's Festival.
Fuck. Yes, it is.
And then
it is,
it's
so
about
interesting.
Camp Trans, because Michigan Women's Festival is trans exclusive, but only of trans women. When it's a women's festival, make you think.
Make you fucking think.
And about Camp Trans, which is the kind of splinter festival that's happening across in a field across the road, which is trans inclusive and specifically centres trans women. And just, like, the struggles and politics of that. I loved that.
It was so interesting. Really fucking interesting.
Do you know which... It was definitely one of the darker essays, but the essay that I was so obsessed with was the one about the Hags, the, like, punk crew of San Francisco.
Yeah.
Who all... Well, a lot of them experienced an extremely unpleasant death. Because of black tar heroin, a thing I had literally never heard of until I read this book and hope to never hear of again.
Yep.
I went through so many emotions with this book. Obviously, unlike in The Dream House, it has a lot more highs.
Yeah.
It has some real lows, like people with necrotic flesh-eating skin diseases because of the way that they have ingested heroin. That's quite a low in anyone's life, I would say. But it has some real... highs. That sound was the sound of my elbows clicking.
Every bone in her body.
Yeah, her decrepit body. So I hope you enjoyed the sound of me putting my hands in the air to emphasise how good I felt reading this book. Tell me about what did you know about her before you read this?
So, she wrote a book called Black Tea.
No, Black Wave.
I'm going to say that again. She wrote a book called Black Wave.
If you think I'm going to edit that out, you are wrong.
Sorely mistaken. Yes. Fuck you, Bert. So she wrote a book called Black Wave that was a big hit around 2016-ish, 2015-ish. But I never got around to reading it. So I went in very ignorant. And I read it specifically because we had the opportunity to interview her for the pod. At Two Sons at the Barbican Centre.
New Sons.
What's Two Sons?
I think that's a thing from, like, a sci-fi book.
Anyway, whatever. New Sons.
Which is a literary festival at the Barbican run by Sarah Shin, among other people, a cool person that we know.
So anyway, so I basically read it in advance of interviewing Michelle at the festival. And I was absolutely struck by how much I loved it. I expected to enjoy it. You're right, it is called New Sons. I was just Googling, so I didn't believe you. I don't know why I ever question your memory, because it's fucking
my mind. I know we say that a lot, but, like, my actual mind, you know.
But yeah, I really loved it. And then I felt so fucking lucky that I then got to go and talk to Michelle and ask her all my questions, which you, our dear listeners, will now get to listen to, well, in a bit when we're done. We're going to tack the interview on the end of this episode because, unfortunately, the festival was very busy, and although we had space to record, it was actually a green room that was being used. So people were coming and going, and the interview ended up being cut short because it was just too disruptive. So it's not really long enough to stand on its own. So that's why we're kind of tacking it onto the end of our
general discussion.
Yeah, just a
little bit of content chat. So before you read this book, you were aware of Michelle T, but you were not. You hadn't read anything by her.
And I kind of knew, all I really knew was that people who like her fucking love her. And now I understand why.
Yeah, so this was my, you know, similar vibes in that before I read this, I'd never read anything by her. But many women who I have loved in my life, like many of the like queer women of my dating life circa, you know, like 2012, 2013, 2014, were very into her. And I was always like, oh, it's for people who are like cooler and more edgy than me. Like I really perceived that it was for like more people who were like more real than me. And that I was...
She did a little peace sign.
I did a cool peace sign as I said that. So then when I read it, I was really surprised at how like joyful and accessible it was. Just in relation to, like, the people from my life that have responded to her.
I think that's, like, a perfect description of how she herself is.
Yes.
Joyful and accessible. She had time for everyone. I also, before interviewing her, went to a panel, or, like, an in-conversation with, that Michelle did with Sarah Shin, the festival organiser. And they were it was talking specifically about tarot, because that's one of Michelle's, like, big things. She has a book called Modern Tarot that if you're into that kind of thing, you may enjoy. And I'm very kind of, it's not really my world, you know, it's not my scene. But I went along because it was the most convenient way to, like, hook up with Michelle afterwards. And I just really enjoyed, like, she has this very open way of speaking. Everything she said was interesting. The room was absolutely packed with people who were just so engaged in what she was saying. And even though, as I said, like, tarot isn't my vibe, she just had this incredibly, like, gentle and accessible way of talking about it. Like, she's very funny and dry, and she wasn't taking herself too seriously, and, can't help but stan, as they say on the internet.
Because I feel like, as much as she is very upbeat and accessible, she's also very, like, radical and willing to very much, like, self-criticize and self-interrogate. I think some of the most interesting ideas in the book are around her relationship with trans men and the extent to which she feels the need to reassure people around her and herself that she is still, like, queer enough, even though she is in a relationship with a man, and in doing that, the way that that kind of slightly invalidates her partner's, like, masculinity and needs, the way that Michelle feels the need to ally her male partners with womanness in order to justify her continued existence in queer spaces. I found that so interesting.
Really interesting. And especially a lot of the conversations that she mentions in Against Memoir, you realise that I was relatively new to this chat. I was introduced to, like, a lot of the kind of dialogue around, like, transness and the battles that trans people are kind of facing at the moment. I was relatively new to them all, and finding out that, you know, this community have been having these same fights for fucking decades. You know, the exact same conversations, like, an essay that could have been written yesterday was written in the 90s,
yes,
you know?
So true.
It was really interesting. I think that you're right, though. That's something that I love, is that she does not come from a preachy place. She very much comes from, like, a, we are all learning, and that's really cool, as long as we're here with our, like, little thinking caps on and we're prepared to engage. And, like, I really loved, there's an essay that, oh, damn, we don't have the book with us. I want to double check what it's called. It's called something like How Not to Be an Asshole.
Yeah. In the queer community.
And it's about, like, calling people out, without, like, enjoying it too much, Like, about, like, how, actually, when we're calling people out within our own communities, we should be doing it from, like, a good place. Like, we should be doing it for the greater good, not so we can feel like little smarty pants.
Yeah.
And that really, like, resonated with me, because I feel like, obviously, I mean, I read it before the kind of chat we're currently having on Twitter about kindness, but it reminded me a lot of some of the, like, less savoury vibes that we can sometimes find on Twitter,
so
where people
true.
Are waiting to see others trip up rather than assuming the best in others.
Yeah, I feel like there is just a lot to get out of this book in terms of, like, personal learnings, but also history of queer scenes that you might not know about, queer media you might not know about, or maybe you do, but just hearing about it from a really interesting, impassioned person. Really interesting to learn about Michelle T's life, her personal experiences. She has truly lived a life.
Yeah.
She's done a lot. She has
lived a life.
Yeah.
She's still fucking going. God, yeah. Love her. Yeah.
I just loved this so much. Like, I'm now the one woman Michelle T street team.
street team.
Was it? It's Grace Harrison that loves it when I call myself street team.
That has killed me.
Grace Harrison, who is a delightful Picador publicist, who I hope we see soon.
Wednesday at the Picador party.
Yes. I love the expression street team.
I love it. It made me immediately think of, like, you just imagine all these goths in the 90s putting it on their CV. Like, I was part of the Amy street team.
The Marilyn Manson, yeah. Dick sucking street team.
I'm on the Marilyn Manson sucking dick street team.
I feel like that's the street team I'm living in a lot at the moment.
What, the Marilyn Manson sucking his, yeah, dick?
Yeah. I feel like I talk about it quite a lot.
I mean,
I do.
It's come out now on two pods. Recorded in the same afternoon, but I think this is going to be the new... What used to come up in every single pod?
Jenny Tighe.
Jenny Tighe. Silence of the Lambs.
Yeah, Silence of the Lambs. So first we had Silence of the Lambs, then we had our friend Jenny Tighe, and now we have Marilyn Manson...
S-ing his D. Yes.
Yeah, I feel like we've become increasingly naughty with time.
It's our pod, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's also because we've realised that our dream with the podcast is never to have sponsors. We don't need that shit. No. It doesn't matter. So we can say whatever we want. If we want to do a full 45-minute special just talking about
Marilyn Manson doing what we know he loves to do, then we can. But if you did want to give us money, just let me know.
I mean, yeah.
We need money.
I'm not saying that we don't want money. I'm just saying that we don't want a mattress company telling us that we can't talk about Marilyn Manson sucking his own dick.
So true. But yeah, please, if you like stuff that I like, please read Against Memoir by Michelle T.
And then please at us with all your feelings.
Yes.
Because when I finished this book, all I wanted to do was talk to people about it. And I felt like, I'm sure it did great because she has such a massive following, but I didn't feel like I was seeing much of it on Twitter from, it didn't, like, the people who, yeah, I trust, you know?
It was, I feel like when In the Dream House came out, you knew In the Dream House had come out because, yeah, it was everywhere. It was, yeah, like on every discerning queer's Twitter.
Yep.
But I didn't feel like that with Against Memoir.
I think it's definitely because her core fan base seems to be like the tarot, astrology, crystal queers, you know, which we don't, although I have like one little foot in that because I like witchy looking shit. I'm very much like an aesthetic.
She says wearing a crystal goth necklace.
Yeah, it's from New Orleans. It's very dear to me. Yeah. All right.
I don't judge.
But I don't charge it. Do you know what I mean? Like,
Yeah.
This is like the perfect example of how basic my interest is in the occult.
It's purely aesthetic.
Pure goth joy, you know? Yeah. So yeah, I feel like maybe it's because I don't like follow as many people in that arena who maybe were going for this book. If you're listening to this and all of that is your jam and you haven't read it, treat yourself.
Just do it now. Yeah. And it's published by A Cause More Press.
Who's it again? It's And Other Stories. Yeah.
Isn't that great?
Yeah. Again, we were just talking about how much we love small presses and here they are once again. Publishing something fucking interesting, you know?
So like, interesting.
Also because all of this work would have been floating around for fucking years, you know? And it's really exciting to just see it all anthologized,
yeah,
ordered, given some love. One question that I asked her, which you will hear in the recording in a minute, so I won't like rehash, but I did ask her what it was like to revisit like work that she had produced earlier, which is what I wanted to bring up with you now, because I guess one of the things with like both these books, In the Dream House and Against Memoir, it's like looking back at writing that from a different period in one's life. And I feel like I spend a lot of time opening up old documents, seeing what stories I have. Maybe I can redraft something. Is there anything good in there? And sometimes it's so monumentally embarrassing, you know? And I just have so much respect for, like, these writers that have been doing amazing shit and not really reaching the spotlight, you know? I just think Michelle T's amazing. And I hope that she is working on new stuff.
Yeah.
Fiction or non-fiction, I don't really care. I just want to, like, I want to hear her opinion on everything.
And I want to hear her tales and her stories about working in well, like an ice cream shop. And
yeah, I want to hear about her being a young queer goth.
And, like, you know? How obviously she was fucking up her hair all the time because, like, just putting pure bleach on it, and it just must have looked like absolute garbage. And, I loved the lightness and I loved the darkness. I felt like I just wanted to hear more about her world and her experiences. Can you imagine anything worse than reading your old live journal?
So
maybe you would be all right because you are, like, the master.
My life journal was writing practice, so I would draft and redraft my entries before they went live.
Alice's live journal entries were always the best live journal entries because they were long and they were good.
So, like, I have, in the process of trying to save my journal, because I'm terrified of losing it, I have revisited some of it, and sometimes I'm struck by, like, particularly because I had one from the age of 16 to about 26, I had about 10 years. And I'm struck often by how much nicer my entries are. Like, I remember so much negativity and anger and, like, stress and anxiety. I remember a lot of sad feelings. And I'm very struck looking back. Like, I remember myself as being meaner than I actually was. Like, reading my teenage journals, I was just, like, a nice little goth, really.
Yeah,
wasn't
you were.
I? Like, it was fine. Gorge. So I quite enjoy indulgently reading my own journal.
But 2021, my concept... Against Journal by Alice Slater.
You know that's my dream. I considered pitching this to a press that were looking for nonfiction recently. I want to do, not my own journal, but I would love to do an anthology of live journal entries.
I want only your journal. Only you, no one else. Everyone else is shit.
We'll see.
So, stay tuned to hear a little chat between legend Alice Slater and legend Michelle T.
Enjoy.
See you on the flip side, my friends.
Bye. I'm with Michelle T.
Hello.
How's it going, Michelle?
Good. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. I'm snazzed to be here.
Same.
So we just come from Michelle did a talk called Modern Tarot, which was based on your passion and experience with tarot readings and tarot cards.
Yes.
It was really fun.
Good. I'm glad. I want people to know that tarot is really enjoyable.
So something that really struck me in your talk was talking about, like, the rituals of magic.
Uh-huh.
I wanted to know if you bring any of that into your writing practices.
You know, I do sometimes. Like, I'll definitely bring a particular crystal that's charged for creativity or kind of overcoming blocks and have that with me while I'm working. Or I'll light particular candles and do candle spells for creativity and for, like, again, to clear blockages, to clear creative blockages. So, yeah, I do that sometimes for sure. I think it's really helpful.
And do you have any, like, writing rituals in themselves that helps you get going?
I have had writing rituals, but I have found that writing rituals tend to come back and bite you on the butt because then you start believing that that's... The ritual is the magic, because writing is so, for me anyway, it's so subconscious and mysterious that, you know, you get into this kind of trancey flow zone and you're like, where is this all coming from? And I find that I can get very superstitious about my rituals and think that, oh, the ritual brought the writing. Like, I didn't bring the writing, the ritual did. So I try to not be too superstitious in that way because I have found that it works against my writing because... I used to think, like, oh, after a certain point, when I used to write into notebooks, after a certain point, the notebook went bad. It just was a bad notebook. It was so wasteful. I couldn't write in it anymore. It was bad, you know, or I needed a certain pen. And, of course, I don't, you know. And then sometimes it doesn't feel like a ritual. It just sounds very practical. Like, I need to write first thing in the morning. Or I need at least, you know, 5 hours to write. Or I can't write after I've answered emails. The day's ruined if that, you know, or I have to be alone. I can't be around people. Like, all of these things I feel like I feel like writers can be very superstitious. And maybe those things are pointing to your sort of optimum situation for writing, but you can write no matter what. So I try not to have those kind of rituals because they just keep me from writing, and I don't need that.
I think that's definitely what I found, that I think we do encourage, like, people who are kind of new to writing to develop rituals.
Uh-huh.
And, like, habit is good.
Habit is really good.
But ritual, I realized that sometimes when I would feel like, nope, this is ruined, the moment's gone or whatever.
Right.
I was making excuses.
Yes, totally. Or, like, that just means, you know, you came out of the flow. you can maybe get yourself back into the flow, or maybe not, maybe you're done for the day, you know, and that's valid too. But it's I think it's really important to know that, like, you're the writer. The writing is coming mysteriously somehow from or through you, and it doesn't matter what pen you use or if you've got that crystal or if you're sitting in your special seat or wearing your magic underwear. It doesn't matter. You can still do some writing and produce a little work.
And have you always been a writer? Did you write as a kid?
I did, yeah. I really feel like I have always been a writer. I've always been narrating everything I see in my head. I tried to write a novel when I was in first or second grade. I wrote a whole bunch of poetry when I was in like third grade. Yeah, I started a school newspaper when I was in second grade. So I was very prolific when I was in first and second grade. Were prolific writing years for me.
Perhaps some of your best work.
Yeah, I'll never be able to capture that.
And do you still have any of that stuff, or is it all lost to the seas of time?
Bizarrely, I think that I do have like a mimeograph of the poems, and possibly, yeah, some of the stuff my birth father had held on to, and so when he passed away, I got it, and I was shocked that he had it, and shocked at the passion of these poems that I wrote when I was in third grade against, like, hunting. But, like, I never knew hunting. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. I lived a really urban life. Like, I had all these, like, passionate poems against hunters and stuff. It's like, I guess I must have seen Bambi, I think, is what happened.
I mean, I'd say Bambi has inspired a lot of work. Yeah,
totally.
And do you think maybe part of that was feeling that that's what you were supposed to be writing poetry about?
I wonder, you know, for sure. And then I also wonder, where did I get that from? Because it wasn't like I was exposed to a lot of poetry or to a lot of, like, activism or people speaking up for things. I wasn't exposed to any of that, although I was a very voracious reader and I was always at my local libraries. So it's possible that, yeah, I picked that up somewhere, you know.
And what kind of books were you reading in your formative years?
Oh, gosh. I loved scary books where, like, girls found, like, were being haunted by ghosts, you know. I loved that. I love Lois Duncan. I always read above my age, and I really started loving books basically with, like, girls getting in trouble, like girls doing drugs, girls running away, girls getting pregnant, girls sick and in the hospital, just, like, these genres of, like, girls in trouble, you know.
Still what I love.
Yeah, I know, right? totally, yeah. Yeah, I loved all of that stuff. I'm actually haunted by some, the memory of some books that I read when I was really young, and I wish that I could find them, and I've gone on different forums on the internet of, like, you know, horror books, you know, for teens released in, you know, 1976 or whatever, trying to find some, but...
So, thinking about revisiting your writing as a kid, Against Memoir is a memoir of revisiting writing too. Mm-hmm. How did it come to be?
I mean, honestly, it came to be because I wanted to have a book out without writing one. I thought I could just gather, right? Isn't that the dream? Like, can I just have a book and go on a tour and not actually do the work? It was because it was after my book Black Wave, and I was a little stumped about what to write from there, and I still am, to be honest. But I knew I had all these journalistic pieces and one-offs that were sort of floating around, and I liked the idea of them all having a home together. So I pitched it to the feminist press, and they said yes, but they were like, you also have to write new essays.
Oh, God.
So I did have to do a bunch of work, but it was great because they were ideas I'd had for essays that I'd never pitched them anywhere. They were just sort of sitting in my mind, and I thought, oh, this is great. I'll work on those stories for it. So,
and why did you decide, rather than putting them chronologically, to order them the way that you did? So they're sort of split by vague sort of genre.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that was actually my editor at the beginning of the project was Jennifer Baumgartner, and I believe that was her idea, but I really liked it because I think that, you know, to do it chronologically, my voice and my interests have changed, you know, through time, and so you could just start, it could have made it so that the book started slow and ended good, or started good and ended, I don't know. To have it all kind of jump in a jumble, I think, created a better texture, you know?
Yeah, it definitely worked for me. Yeah.
Oh, good. I'm glad.
But also what really struck me is, obviously, because they're not in chronological order, mm-hmm. sometimes I had no idea where I was until I got to the end of the day. But it really worked because we've been having the same arguments and conversations recently as you were having like 15 years ago.
Oh, is that depressing or what?
Kind of both. I mean, I feel like it makes the book timeless for a start.
Mm-hmm.
Some in ways that it shouldn't be because we should be past some of these things. But I guess in terms of like creating this like record of queer history, like, we need to know, you know?
Yeah, it's important. It's important. Queer history goes undocumented. I mean, in even with, like, the accumulation of various rights, like, you know, the stuff that's happening on the fringes is always the most interesting and powerful stuff, and that doesn't get documented, so.
I mean, like, so the essay about Camp Trans and the Michigan Women's Music Festival was one that really like struck a chord with me because these conversations are happening a lot right now in the US and the UK. And I hadn't actually heard of, for my ignorance, I hadn't heard of the Michigan Women's Festival until I read Paul Takes the Form of a Mortal Girl.
I love that book so much. It's such a great book.
It is an amazing book, right?
It's fantastic.
And I just, I don't know, I just loved having this like greater context to this like little, it's a scene in Paul Takes the Form of a Mortal Girl by Andrea Lawler that came out this year in the UK. There's a whole scene where the main character Paul goes to the festival and experiences how would you describe it, some issues being there as this being who can change their body to suit their mood and time. It was really interesting to me to just read this totally different kind of take on that festival.
It's so great that they put that in there.
And did you find like revisiting some work, was some parts of it difficult to revisit? I'm thinking specifically like, has your mind changed, or was there anything that you had put in your work then that maybe you wouldn't put now?
If that was the case, then those essays probably didn't make it into the book. You know, and there were some pieces like that, just because like understanding around like queer and trans issues has shifted so swiftly, really, that there were some pieces where I just felt like it was the language, it was a little dated, and I know that the people that were in the story had either transitioned. There were some pieces that I felt like time had passed it by, and there wasn't a lot to get out of it by putting it in there. It didn't feel like a interesting look back at a time. It just looked like, I don't know, I just didn't want it in there. But for Camp Trans, I felt like I was so generous to the festival. And it's interesting, somebody had commented on that, and I realized it was because at the time I wrote it, there was still a hope that they would actually change their policy. And so I think holding out that hope, you know, I didn't want to go apocalyptic on the festival, but I think my ending is a little bit more fuck you, because they did end the festival rather than let it include all women. They decided to just close it, which is so gross.
And just to clarify for anyone listening, the policies that were being discussed was that the Michigan Women's Music Festival was a women-only space. The debate was whether or not trans women should be included in that.
I mean, which is like, it's so offensive to even question
it. It shouldn't be a question.
It's so offensive to even question it. And so my tone, I was a little taken aback at how generous my tone was until I remembered that it was the debate was still sort of in play, and there was still, it felt like a possibility because so many people really wanted trans women to be part of that festival. But, you know, it wasn't a collective that created that festival. It was a business, and one woman owned it, and it was all up to her. And she made that call.
It seemed to me as well that so many people wanted the festival to work. Like, it was so important to so many people.
It really was.
And it's hard to let go of stuff that you love, even when it starts to actually be quite damaging.
Yeah.
So I can totally understand why writing, I mean, I know that you weren't invested in the festival in the same way as some of the women that have been going every year. But
no, but I had been there, and I had experienced how magical it is. And to withhold that sort of magic from sort of the women in the community that could most really benefit from a magical space in our culture is so awful. And I just think they all have to live with themselves for making that decision, you know? I don't know.
Well, they created something great and then they fucking ruined it.
Yeah, totally. Totally.
The other essay that really felt like poignant for today, although it wasn't written that long ago, but the How Not to Be a Queer Douchebag.
that was actually written a little while ago. How many?
It was like a few years, five
it
years?
It was like five, I guess maybe 5 years or so. Yeah, maybe a little longer than that.
Well, it just really struck me. But the spirit of it, of one section of it anyway, is like about call-out culture.
Uh-huh.
And it's just like, we don't all start like where we are now.
Yeah.
We have to go through some stuff, and sometimes we have to educate ourselves or educate others. And it's just this vibe of like, it's hard calling people out.
Uh-huh.
So don't get too into it.
Like, yeah, you know, like, do it, of course. Like, you know, I want to be accountable, right, for my blind spots. Like, I am, you know, a cisgendered white person who was raised in white supremacy. Like, I'm not going to act like being anti-racist means being committed to unlearning the racism that you've been soaking in your whole life, you know, and I don't pretend it's anything other than that. But, you know, when somebody's just delighting in, you know, calling you out because it signals their own sort of wokeness, it's just annoying. And it stops being like, oh, we're trying to help each other become better people and raise our overall community, and just turns into just kind of a mean-spirited sort of, you know, I don't know. I just don't like it. And I've seen so much of it, and I've seen it over nothing. You know, I mean, like, you know, having to call somebody out on racist behavior is really important. But I've seen call outs around, I don't know, just stuff like, I think it might be from coming from San Francisco and a certain part of like the radical queer subculture where, like, if you even had an ambition, you were suspect as like a capitalist pig or something. Like, I remember somebody calling me like getting heckled at a reading that I was a yuppie. And I was like, am I though? Really? Like, I'm all right. I mean, I guess if I'm what a yuppie looks like to you, like, but yeah. So it's just kind of.
Having obviously now read lots of essays about your childhood and your life, that's quite a bold assertion.
I mean, it's like, do I like nice things? Absolutely. You know, can we have nice things in this community? Debatable. I don't know that we can have nice things in this community. I mean, yeah. So it was a larger kind of like, you know, where are you coming from? Are you just being a fucking jerk, really? Or are you actually trying to like help somebody get woke, you know, and make the world a better place?
And that's the question, isn't it? It's like, is this helpful?
Yeah.
And sometimes maybe it's not.
Yeah, no, maybe sometimes this is just like your opinion. That's not the same as like, you know, calling out, like, I don't know, pointing out something that's actually racist.
And I guess obviously we're specifically thinking about white people and like allies.
Yeah.
You know, like rather than voices from the community, which is a totally different vibe. And that's not what we mean.
100%. 100%. Yeah. I'm talking about like white queers yelling at other white queers, basically. Yeah.
Have you found, as we've started having more of these conversations, or as these conversations have become more mainstream, has it affected the way that you write? Are you more mindful about the kind of characters that you include in your fiction?
I think probably that is true. I mean, I haven't written a lot of fiction as of late. And even Black Wave, which is very fictional, was also based on my own life, you know? But I think it's really important as a writer to think about, like, you know, are you default subconscious writing this? If you're a white person, are you at default subconsciously writing this for other white people? And I think that is often the case if you're not looking at it. Like, I read a lot of writing from other people, and you can just feel it. And I'm sure my writing also has had that flavor to it, but I miss it because it's my own blind spot, you know. But I mean, part of that, I think, it's like, when I think about who I'm writing for, I'm writing for a version of myself. And I think that is kind of normal and people do that, but I think it's to be questioned, because then I'm just writing for other white girls. You know what I mean? And it's like, you need to be thinking broader than that. And I think that it requires you kind of like poking yourself in your brain a little bit to kind of wake yourself up out of that as a white person.
And does that mean as well, just like, trying to read as much and experience as much from other parts of the community? Like,
oh, hell yeah. Oh, yeah. You should be reading people of color's work. I mean, everybody should be reading people of color's work. White people should 100% be reading the work of people of color. Yeah. I try to always, like, if I'm at a, I mean, and this is a privilege to be able to spend money on books for sure, but I do try to, like, if there's a book that I know that I want and it's by a white writer, I buy work by a person of color as well, just to expose myself, because, I mean, it's very likely that that white writer, through white privilege, has benefited from, like, a greater push. And there's a reason why maybe I know about their book as opposed to having to search out, you know, a writer of color and do a little bit of that work. But, I mean, that's fun work to do. yeah. in the bookstore, right? I mean, like, it's really fun work to do.
Yeah, I can definitely think of worse ways of spending my time, right?
Yeah, finding cool writing by people of color.
Before we finish, I have two quick questions to ask you, which Bethany and I always like to ask each other as well.
Okay.
So first of all, what books would you recommend to listeners who have read your work, loved it, and are looking to read more similar stuff?
Okay. I would read... I guess I'm thinking of books I love, you know, that my book would be really happy hanging out with. Brontes Purnell, all of his work, whether it's his zines or his novel Since I Laid My Burden Down, and Johnny, Would You Love Me If My Dick Were Bigger, and the Cruising Diaries. His work is genius. He's amazing. He just won the Whiting Award in the States. So I would really say him. Laurie Weeks's book Zippermouth remains a classic to me. I love it very, very much. Love the poetry of Morgan Parker. I love the poetry of Justin Chin, who's a poet that we lost maybe coming up on 4 years ago. And I'm very influenced by Justin Chin's writing, his poetry. So I would read all of his work. I mean, I feel like it goes without saying Eileen Miles, but I'll just say it, just to say it, you know.
What I've learned is it never goes without saying.
Yeah, you're right, you gotta say it. Every single thing that Eileen Miles has ever written.
Where would we start with Eileen Miles? Chelsea Girls?
Yeah, start with Chelsea Girls. Then, I mean, you know, they write prose and poetry, so start with Chelsea Girls for prose. They just had their collected I Must Be Living Twice come out, so you can just kind of devour all of that. And other poetry I love is Ariana Raines, C.A. Conrad, Jericho Brown's poetry is incredible, Tommy Pico.
There is like a wealth of knowledge.
Linda Barry. Oh my God, read everything Linda Barry's ever done. She just won a MacArthur Genius Grant, which is exciting. Oh, and so did Maggie Nelson a few years ago. Maggie Nelson.
My God, Maggie Nelson.
Yeah, oh my God, Maggie Nelson.
Right? Firm favorite on the pod.
Yeah. Oh, good, good, good.
Can't get enough.
Yeah, she's so fantastic.
Okay, and then my final question is, what are you reading right now?
Oh gosh, I was reading Trans by Juliette Jacques on the train here today from Newcastle. I was reading that book, and I was also reading Viv Albertine's, was it called Close, 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 Music, 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 Close, 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 Boys, Boys, Boys. Yeah. I just started reading that. And other books I have with me, I have In at the Deep End, which is by a British writer, Katie, oh man, I can't remember her last name. It's a really fun book about a girl who realizes she's a lesbian sort of later in her dating life.
And into
it's really fun. It's really, really fun. I'm also reading, the folks at Category Is Books in Glasgow gave it to me. Oh, Olivia Lang's The Lonely City.
Oh, my God.
Which is a really great book to read when you're traveling alone by yourself, right?
Another pod favorite.
Oh, really? Yeah. I love her book Crudo so much. Yeah. I was so blown away by how good that is. So, yeah, I think I'm reading, like, all British literature right now.
Good.
I know. Yeah, I'm into it.
When in Rome.
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay, so we are in the green room of this festival, and people are coming in and out.
Yes,
so
they are.
We are going to wrap this up. This has been so much fun.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Such a nice time. Thank you so
much.
Please go and read Michelle T's new book. It's called Against Memoir. It's fucking wicked. It is a certified banger and a new pod favorite. Catch you next time. Bye.
Bye.